and you're tuning the antenna by putting a tuning capacitor on the input end of the transmission line going to the antenna, assuming the transmission line is lossless. So you're tuning the antenna at the shack end, which makes the signal generator complex. And how can all of that power be re-reflected with no loss, is what you're asking. And yes, that's a tough one. There was a puzzle somewhat like this in the, what's the name of the, QEX? QEX magazine had a puzzle a couple of years ago that I gave an answer to, where you've got two separate signal generators on opposite sides of a transmission line. And one signal generator is more powerful than the other, and they're both a 50-ohm load and so on. You're supposed to predict what voltages and currents exist along the transmission line with two separate transmitters, one on each end of the transmission line. Under normal circumstances, that's a pretty tough problem of superposition. But there are ways of taking that apart and proving where all the energy and voltage and power is going. And so, set up correctly, if you've got a pure 50-ohm impedance signal generator running 50 watts on the left side, and another pure one running 100 watts on the right-hand side, your left-hand signal generator is going to have to dissipate 100 watts extra. Your right-hand signal generator is going to have to dissipate 50 watts extra. They don't have to be on the same frequency. It doesn't matter. But if the signal generator is a pure 50-ohm resistor, DC to light, the power flowing out of one signal generator goes over to the other signal generator and gets thoroughly absorbed. And whether or they're on the same frequency, opposite frequencies, in phase, out of phase, doesn't matter. That will happen. But now to predict what voltages you're going to see in the middle of that transmission line, depending on wavelengths and frequencies, it gets a little bit complicated. I remember giving an answer to that, and I remember them saying that mine was the only answer they got that fit the laboratory measurement. They had Berg wattmeters on that transmission line making measurements when they did that test. Over to you, John, KQRIW.
Yeah, this one has really been a head-scratcher for me. I think it has something to do with the general superposition of power, which in general it doesn't superpose. I think it's somewhat related to that, in that in the reflected direction going back towards the tuner, you're trying to superpose the reflected power with the generator power, and I think that's where it gets a little hokey. I know. I mean, there are times when you have when you can have a mismatch, and there will be less power dissipated in the generator. For example, take that resistive generator. Okay, hooked up the line with a 50-ohm resistor. Okay, so now the generator sees 50 ohms. But let's say the line is a half wavelength long, and now the load goes open circuit. So a half wave from an open circuit is an open circuit again. So now the generator thinks it's working into an open circuit. Its internal power dissipation is zero. In other words, the full double, as you mentioned before, double voltage appears across the generator terminals internally. In the internal resistance of the generator, we don't dissipate any power. So I think superposition of power has something to do with this question. Okay.
When a 7 equivalent signal generator, which is an ideal voltage generator in series with a 50-ohm resistor, when it sees an open circuit, the power dissipated within the signal generator is zero. If the signal generator was a Norton equivalent, a 50-ohm resistor with an ideal current generator across it, a Norton signal generator looking into an open circuit has maximum power dissipation. It only has zero power dissipation if it sees a short circuit. So depending on whether your signal generator is a Norton equivalent or a Thevenin equivalent, you get two different answers as to what's the power dissipated inside the signal generator. Over to you, John.
Yes, which I think is another way of saying that that superposition of power is not a good idea. I think it generally doesn't work. Only works for some very special cases, like when the sine waves are in quadrature or at different frequencies. So I think it's related to that, but it's something I have to do more study on. But thank you, Dick, for the time. I really appreciate it.
Hey, you and I are both perplexed by how a ideal antenna tuner can do its magic and not waste any power, run ice cold, and all the reflected power gets re-reflected forward and radiated. There's another point I was going to make about this one. Went out of my mind. Oh, yes. Mother Nature thinks in voltage and current. If you've got a linear circuit, real resistors, real inductors, real capacitors, and no nonlinear circuits like diodes and transistors and whatever, you can always use superposition. Voltages will in phase, out of... Mother Nature thinks in voltage and thinks... Mother Nature does not think in power. So you try to line up things in power, you'll quite often come up with wrong answers. If I've got a multipath environment, and every RF path that you and I have ever used is multipath, I may think that my transmitter's on top of this mountain, and my receiver's on top of another mountain 10 miles away. You think there's nothing but a straight signal going through the air between the two? Absolutely not. The signal coming out of your transmitter is bouncing off of every single object in that environment, off of every one of those trees and water towers and buildings. And those signals reflected off of those objects arrive at the receiving antenna. You add up all the individual voltages in a vector manner, amplitude and phase angle. Add up all those individual voltages coming out the receiving antenna, add them together, that is the composite voltage that will be going down that transmission line. So Mother Nature, in a linear system, does think in voltage or think in current, not in power. You add up the individual powers, you come up with a very wrong answer. So any of the equations that we study in systems like this, you got to convert things into voltage or current, whichever is your favorite, and use 7 equivalents and Norton equivalents. Anybody with any further questions or comments on this before we go over to Roy, give me your call letters right now, K2RIW.
Question.
Okay, start off with your call letters and name. Person who said question, go right ahead.
K2GJE, Ed, what happens if at the end of the line we have just a coil and a capacitor that tunes to the right frequency and looks like 50 ohms? Does that coil and capacitor dissipate the power? Over.
You've got a little bit of conflict of terms there, Ed. If it's a pure inductor and a pure capacitor, and whether you got them in series, parallel, or whatever the combination, there is no way that if there's no loss in the inductor and no loss in the capacitor, there is no way that can become 50 ohms. That circuit is always going to be reactive if it's a pure inductor or pure capacitor. So it cannot absorb power. Pure inductor and pure capacitor cannot continuously absorb power. They can absorb power on the first half cycle of the RF wave, and they give it back on the second half cycle. The net power flow into an inductor or into a capacitor is zero. So there's got to be loss somewhere for that to give you 50 ohms. And the same thing when it comes to a very high Q cavity filter, like a coaxial reentrant cavity. People will say, I tap it at the 50 ohm point. There is no such thing. There is no 50 ohm point to tap that filter. Once you define the output load network, and now you look at the input to that filter, yes, there is a circuit, there is a place along that rod where you will see 50 ohms when a real load is presented on the other side. But a pure resonator does not have any resistance to it. You cannot make it give you a 50 ohm load if it's pure. Does that make some sense, Ed? Over to you, K2RIW.
Yes, I should think that could dissipate power. Yet, if I have a real piece of wire out there and I correct it at the antenna with a coil or a capacitor, that will dissipate power. Over.
Absolutely. Now, that coil that you're talking about has some series resistance to its wire. It's got some skin effect going on with its wire. It's got other objects around it. Your hand is an absorptive object. So in that environment, the antenna is dissipating some of it with resistance, dissipating a lot of it with radiation. So some of that signal out of that coil is being radiated into space. and there's also near field resistive loading going on. Your hand being near that coil. Your hand has got a lot of water in it, and water at RF frequencies is very absorptive. Mr. Southworth, the guy who did a lot of work on waveguide in 1938 at Bell Labs, he took a piece of downspout tubing, made it almost parallel, tilted it at a very shallow angle, and had water in the bottom of it. So the water presented a sharp wedge of water inside of that downspout tubing. That became a piece of waveguide with a perfect dummy load. The water in that case, when you slowly absorb the water as a sharp edge like that, it does a beautiful job of absorbing the RF and turning it into heat. Your hand does a beautiful job of doing that. So you can take that coil and hook it up in fancy ways to make it act like 50 ohms because of its real loss, its real radiation, and the real near-field loading of your hand holding onto that coil. K2GJE, K2LIW.
Okay, I must remember that. It's just impossible unless you got something else out there other than a pure capacitor and a pure coil inductor at the end of the line. What would it look like? Well, all the power would come back. There would be no way of anything to absorb it, except maybe some loss on the coaxial cable, over.
Yeah, if your inductor or capacitor at the far end of your transmission line is in a well-shielded box, so it cannot radiate the signal, and because of the well-shielded box, it can't see your hand that's holding onto it, and assuming the coil is a very low-loss fat wire coil, made out of silver-plated wire, there's no way, without putting a real resistor in that box, you can make it absorb power. All the power you put into that transmission line going into the box has to be reflected back to you. Because without real resistive load, you cannot continuously absorb RF energy. A pure inductive or capacitive reactance into a well-shielded circuit cannot absorb power. Your antenna tuner is in a well-shielded box. It can't radiate the power. If the inductors and capacitors are high enough in quality, they run ice cold. So if all that power reflected from your antenna, the antenna tuner cannot absorb it. The transmitter sees nothing but a pure 50 ohm load on the input end of the antenna tuner. By conservation of energy, there's nothing left to figure out what's going on except that energy being reflected from the antenna, hitting the output end of the antenna tuner, has to be re-reflected forward and ultimately radiated. There's no other place it can go with the definitions we just used. Over you, Ed, K2RIW.
No, totally agree. I learned something tonight. They never taught this in school, over.
Out of curiosity, what did you learn that you didn't know before, Ed? Go ahead.
I was thinking that a coil and a capacitor could be made to look like a 50 ohm resistor, over.
Absolutely not. If the coil is pure inductance and the capacitor is pure capacitance, no matter how you hook them up schematically, series, parallel, whatever, combinations of them, if they really are pure, there is no way they can present a resistance. Now, you give that capacitor some loss, it's got some series resistance on its leads, you give that inductor some real series resistance in its wire, and yes, there are now ways you can make it resistive in its loading. But if they're pure, there is no so-called 50 ohm point on that filter that you and I are describing. Only when you present a load to it. If the output end of the filter has some kind of a resistive load, now the input end of the filter, with proper tuning, can be made to look like a 50 ohm resistor. But there's got to be real loss to give you 50 ohms. And how did we settle on 50 ohms when most of the world is 70 ohms? All of Europe believes in 70 ohms. All of the cable TV systems in the United States are 70 ohms because that's the impedance where the cable gives you the least amount of loss. And so the dollars you have to pay for the amplifiers that are going along these miles and miles of cable TV line, they chose 70 ohms because of the loss advantage. And so 50 ohms is kind of a compromise. How did we settle on that one? Now, of these, 10 or 11, there's 11 puzzles on this page. We've gone through two or three of them. We'll go through some more of them next week. And now, the other big puzzle maker is Dr. Roy, AC2GS. Go ahead with your puzzle for the night, Roy, K2RIW, the TechNet. you very much, Dick. It's good to be here. And I want to remind people of a few things, but before, let me just touch base on complete components in the real world. My gestalt is that none of them are pure anything, unfortunately. Theoretically, we can have pure capacitors, pure resistors, pure inductors. But in the real life, our inductors have both resistance and capacitance. Our capacitors have resistance and inductance. And resistors probably, to a degree, have capacitance, straight capacitance, and or inductance as well. The only thing I can think of is coming close to the concept of a pure capacitor or a pure conductor would be if you made the stuff out of superconducting material, which is fascinating, but I haven't found any good literature on that subject. I don't know if you did.
One of the experiments that was done at Airborne Instruments Laboratory on the B-1B bomber program, circa 1980-1990, were filters made out of superconducting materials. They really were using cryogenic superconducting materials to make filters. And you do get a more ideal filter when you do it that way. But to always present the cryogenic temperature in order to make the filter work right, That's such a big rigmarole that you don't come out ahead. I mean, you and I could dream that the transmission lines that come from PSE&G's power station in New Jersey coming over to your house could be made out of superconductor, and therefore there would be no loss in those lines. We could dream about that. How do you do that? If we could find a room temperature superconductor, yes. Right now it appears that the only superconductors we can find must be cryogenically cooled. And you've got miles of wire up in the air on those utility poles, and you want that wire to be kept at a cryogenic temperature. Wow. The 1.5 Tesla and 3 Tesla magnet that's inside of your MRI machine does have a superconducting magnet in there, which is being cryogenically cooled with liquid helium. And that machine has to go through a lot of rigmarole to make sure that liquid helium is always there to maintain that magnetic field. Over to you, Roy. AC2GS, K2RIW.
Yes, indeed. Superconducting material is fascinating stuff. There's type 1, there's type 2. They figured out why type 1 works. They're still a little bit confused about type 2, which has a slightly warmer tolerance. But they both require extreme cold temperatures. But they're working on different materials to see if they could tweak it up. That would be a great discovery, to find something that was superconducting at room temperature, that wasn't ridiculously expensive to manufacture, that was mechanically stable. But maybe someday I'll do a story on that, hopefully, when they discover that one. Let me drop for a sec.
Yeah, what is the difference between type 1 and type 2 superconductor? Give us some words on that one, Roy.
Well, the problem is type 1 was the earliest type of superconductor, and physicists were a little confused of how superconductors work at all. They had no underlying theory. Then they came up with a very, very interesting thing that entails something called Cooper pairs, which are pairs of electrons that become linked to each other, and so the electrons going from one to the next have no loss in thermal energy. They don't bounce up against anything. They just kind of smear across. So Cooper pairs are somewhat better understood in type 1 superconductors, and has a limited temperature range. You can't make one above a certain very cold temperature. And then they discovered new materials that violated that. And apparently it's because it works on a different concept other than Cooper pairs. And it has slightly different characteristics. Type 1 superconductors can totally shield magnetic fields, whereas type 2 superconductors allow little imperfections in the magnetic field to go through, but they're locked in position.
So you could take a superconducting piece of material, suspend it above a bunch of magnets, and depending on where you push it down to or let go, it'll maintain that particular altitude as it goes around the track. I think you and I have seen those experiments. So I think you're saying you could you could force it to go around the track, 1 inch above the track or 2 inches above the track, and it'll keep that distance as it goes around. Over to you, Roy. Is that a type 2?
Yes, Dick, exactly. There's loads of YouTube experiments where rather than arrange them in motion, they simply position them at different distances away from the material, and they lock into place. It's sort of a fascinating thing to watch. And the reason they give are these holes in the magnetic field that lock them into those separate positions. So type 2 is fascinating. Hopefully someday someone's going to win a really nice Nobel Prize to explain the nuances of type 2 superconducting. And who knows, by then they'll probably have to explain type 3.
Exactly. Well, the thing is that rather than the ring of the conductor, it is a closed loop, there is a magnet that is suspended over the superconductor. And the question to Roy is why? Why not reverse?
You're saying why don't they put the superconductor above and the magnet below?
That is correct. Usually you see... you'd be using the experiment with magnet is built towards the suspension.
That's not what I've seen. I've seen the magnets on the table and the superconducting material that's just taken out of the cryogenic environment and it's smoking. That floats above those magnets on the table. That's what I've seen. Over to you, Roy.
You can do them both ways. The only reason I would think of having a stationary superconducting is it makes life a lot easier to maintain its critical temperature, where you don't have to worry too much about the magnet, and so friction and other things going on doesn't really bother it. So for demonstration purposes, where a video only goes on for a minute or two, you're not worried about the superconductor overheating or such. But they should work no matter what's on top and what's on bottom. It should be a completely symmetrical phenomenon.
What is the highest temperature superconductor you know of, Roy?
Oh, I think we covered that a while ago, and I unfortunately forgot. I would have placed it somewhere around minus 40 degrees, not minus, 40 degrees Kelvin. It's really, really cold. I think you can cool some of the more esoteric materials with liquid nitrogen, and I'd have to check on that. To do the stuff that the conductors, as you mentioned, that are used in medical imaging technology requires much more cryogenic temperatures that you can only get with things like liquid helium.
Yeah, boiling CO2, I think, boils off at 77 Kelvin, something in that neighborhood. And there are a number of superconducting materials that are superconducting at that temperature, I believe.
Okay, well, as I always say, Google is our friend, and Google says about 133 degrees Kelvin is the highest temperature superconductor. It's a interesting admixture of copper, mercury, barium, and calcium.
198 is liquid nitrogen, and that's in Celsius. How that correlates with 48 Kelvin.
Okay, I don't know what to tell you again. I got here 133 degree Kelvin, and they're working on tweaking it up here, there, and elsewhere. Let's see. Although, you know, that's one entry. That was a quick Wikipedia entry. There's another one where they're talking about 250 degree Kelvin, or minus 23 degrees Celsius, as an experimental milestone that some scientists achieved in Germany recently.
Oh, that's an achievement.
I would agree. And usually, I haven't read this one recently. I would assume it's a very esoteric admixture. These things tend to have their own problems in that it's difficult to build them large. They tend to not be terribly strong. materials. So, you know, not only do you have to get something that is superconducting at a relatively high temperature to be useful, but you have to make it out of some material that's reasonably easy to mine, easy to produce, and mechanically stable where it will maintain and not to kind of go bad rather quickly. So there's a lot of more research necessary, but yeah, superconducting materials are kind of fascinating. And initially when I first learned about them, they made no sense to me. It sounded like some violation of the laws of thermodynamics, but nevertheless, they were.
And I will have a question.
Okay, let me do the intro, because I didn't bother to do the intro and do the little puzzler, and after I do the puzzler, I'll ask if anyone has any questions. How's that went?
Good enough.
Okay, well, this is AC2GS, Roy here, with the Science Talk, and as always, I like to remind people, now this week, unfortunately, we didn't get any mailbag questions, but we got them last week, and it was loads of fun, so please, if you have questions and you can't get on the air, send them to me. If you have anything that you want to direct at Paul, a story, a topic, a website that you'd like him to comment on, or if you would like to ask me any questions or topics or suggestions for puzzlers, the email address is mailbag@ac2gs.com. Again, mailbag@ac2gs.com. Most of what I talk about, I will provide links so that you can look at other sources of materials that discuss the subject. And my link page is roy.ac2gs.com. Again, roy.ac2gs.com. And we maintain a little chat room. You can get to it via the Limark website, or you can just type in chat.ac2gs.com, and you'll be directed to the chat room. And I also offer a audio stream of this technical net if, for whatever reason, your EchoLink connection isn't working and your radio isn't working. You just direct your browser at technet.ac2gs.com, and that's the audio stream. Once again, technet.ac2gs.com. And presently, we have four people listening on the audio stream, so that's very good. Let me drop for a second, and I will ask my little puzzler for the night. Okay, tonight's puzzler actually was suggested by Paul, WS2N, our own space reporter. Atoms, there are different atoms from different elements, and there are about 118 known elements on the periodic table. So my question tonight is, of all the elements in the periodic table, which one, if you take a gaseous atom of that particular element and try and knock out its weakest electron, in other words, there's one electron in each neutral atom that requires the least amount of energy than the other electrons in that atom. It's called a valence electron. So the question is, which element has a valence electron with the highest amount of energy required to rip the electron away from that atom?
WB2GXM?
Yes, Rich.
I guess the short answer would be iron.
Okay, would you like to explain why it would be iron?
I am giving you an educated guess, being that iron would be an excellent conductor of electrons.
Okay, well that aspect makes sense, but the question is not which has the weakest amount of energy to lift that electron. It's the atom that has the strongest, the highest amount of energy required to rip that electron out. And in the case of iron, you're probably going on metallic iron. Gaseous iron, it doesn't work the same way. And metallic iron has a delocalized electron. So it's not quite a matter of the ionization energy, but more of a delocalized electron cloud in in metals, crystal grain structure.
Roy, could it be hydrogen or helium? Because that electron is so close, and you have to lift it so far, it could require an awful lot of energy to lift an electron off of hydrogen gas or helium gas, is a guess. Over to you.
Okay, and it's a very good guess. But do you want to kind of narrow it down to a single element, or keep it the way you have it between the two?
I guess I'm going to choose hydrogen. It would be H2, H3, just ordinary hydrogen, I think. To rip that one electron away from it could require quite a bit of energy, is a guess on my part.
Okay, very good. So you vote for hydrogen, Rich votes for iron. Anyone else with any suggestions?
VDH with a comment.
Yes, John.
I'm going to vote for helium, being that it's, the shell is complete, and therefore it would take, I think it would take more energy to pull it off. So I'll vote for helium.
Okay, anyone else with any ideas on the subject?
NY2H.
Yes, Lou.
Just for the heck of it. Since we're going up the periodic table, I'll put in a vote for lithium.
Okay, lithium is an alkali metal with a single electron in its valence shell. As opposed to John's suggestion of helium, which, as he mentioned, has a completed shell of two electrons. And Dick mentioned the hydrogen, which is a single electron in the atom. So we have it spread out. Anyone else with any thoughts on the subject?
Can I put another vote in?
Yes, certainly.
I'm going to put a vote in for fluorine, being that the shell is incomplete and wants to very much to be complete. So it's probably going to be harder to yank an electron off.
Okay, I mean, that's interesting logic. I mean, wouldn't you kind of use the same logic for something that's missing two electrons? You know, instead of a complete, you know, it depends on what shell. We're talking about the N2 shell has eight electrons, and so it likes to have two S electrons and six P electrons. So, I just using that logic, if you had even less P electrons, wouldn't you use the same logic to suggest that that would require more energy?
Well, I thought that it would be closer to completion and therefore would require more to make it more incomplete. It might not be a valid reasoning, but... I'll either vote for helium or fluorine, one of the two.
Okay. Anyone with anything else? You know, anyone has any ideas or wants to agree with one of the answers before? That would be great. The way this works is it has to do with a bunch of different factors. It has to do with how many protons are in the nucleus, but it also has to do with how many other electrons there are in the orbiting shells, and it also has to do with, as John mentioned, completing a shell is a very stable situation. It's a very low energy situation per atom. So when you're starting with an atom that already has a completely filled shell and you're ripping one out, it requires a lot more energy than if you're just ripping off the second or the third valence electron. So although hydrogen does have the benefit of not having any other electrons in its shell messing up the attraction between that and the proton, In the case of helium, you have two protons, which gives you twice the electric charge, and also you have the benefit of filling the valence shell. So actually, helium has the highest ionization energy of all the atoms in the periodic table.
WS2N.
Yes, Paul.
Yeah, that came from Scientific American, so I think it was either last month or the month before. And they talked about the original components of the universe as things started, and that's what happened. You had hydrogen and then helium, but once, you know, helium completed that shell, that was very hard to rip anything apart off of that. So that's where that came from. Back to you, Brian.
Okay, very good, and I really do appreciate Paul giving me that puzzler, because some of these are really difficult to come up with. I came up, though, with a kind of flip side, a reverse direction a puzzle of the same nature that I'll throw in tonight at no extra cost for people to get extra credit. We talked about helium having the highest ionization energy of its valence electron. Anyone would like to hazard a guess which element, atom, has the lowest ionization energy? The one that just would love to lose an electron.
Does this have to be a gas?
Now, for the sake of not complicating matters, all this is basically a atom in the vacuum of space that's not associated with any other atom. So, the closest the definition would be a gas.
Well, I would guess one of the metals in the same column as lithium, lithium, hydrogen, but much further down on the chart in a vapor form. Go ahead.
You are, and the largest reactive alkali metal that's on the periodic table goes by the name of francium. Someone in France discovered it, and so it is very large, has a lot of electrons separating it from the nucleus, and has one extra electron from completing a full shell. So it's francium. So that's the answer to that.
What's the atomic number of that element, Roy?
It's time to Google something. I'll be right back.
I think it's 87.
Indeed, the atomic number is 87. I think I memorized the periodic table back in college. Okay, that's our puzzle for tonight. I hope you were amused, and once again, I thank Paul for offering it up. And anyone out there who has any kind of similar little puzzlers and would like to share them with me, once again, the email address is mailbag@ac2gs.com. Now I will open it all to any questions. Wesley wanted to ask a question tonight, but anyone else who would like to ask a question, this is their time.
It looks like nobody.
Okay, I guess you're on, Wes.
The superconductor itself is in the form of ring, and we want to induce the current in that ring. How would you do it? That's the first question of the series.
You want to induce a current in a superconductor?
In the ring.
Apply a magnetic field across it?
That's the ring. Closed ring, closed loop.
Okay, I mean, do you have the answer to this question?
Yes, I have.
Okay, feel free. I've never built an accelerator.
You throw the magnet to the center of this planet. Should be inevitably formed in, let me put it this way. When you throw magnet to the center, you're inducing the current. By the rule, the current should move forever. There is some variation in type 2 superconducting material, not so perfect. But my question to you, do you know any other material that is not superconducting that would have a current flowing in the ring? Enter a
Well, any conducting material will have a short-lived current. It simply will not survive due to resistance of the structure.
Want to Google isn't then sending the link for you. Viewpoint column. New clues in the mystery of persistent currents.
Okay, I don't really have time to read an article during the technical met. You know, if you want to send me a link email, I'll be more than happy to read up on it.
No, I wanted to, for you to have the keyframe, keyword for it, so you can find it. You don't need to read it. So if we apply the voltage pulse to the wire, we know that the current that starts to flow will eventually disappear. That is because electrons scatter inelastically from photons and other electrons as they flow through the most of metals, and eventually losing all of its energy. However, in metal rings, talking about metal rings, that are smaller than electron phase coherence length, the typical distance the electron travels before it scatters inelastically, it is possible to induce currents that last forever, simply by treating the center of the ring with magnetic flux. So, if we were talking about room temperature superconductor, it's not a superconductor, but it does the effect. And that's why I wanted you just to put in the paper the keyword, new clues in the mystery of persistent currents. Enter it here.
Okay, Wes, I will look it up and read what I can find on it. Once again, anyone has any topics or information or references, they can email them to me and I'll usually look them up and read through them. There's got to be some kind of little gotcha, because if it was as simple as that, my guess is everyone would save millions and millions of dollars on cryogenic freezing of superconducting materials. So there's got to be a couple little ifs, ands, or buts on that.
There is another piece of material. I saw it just today. I didn't look for it or research that. It was Russian propaganda to entertain guys, but it's interesting from the science point of view. Koreans discovered, actually used a droplet, constantly dropping droplet of water to the structure that looks like field transistor, but is on substrate. And by that kinetic energy, I believe, what they say is they didn't say too much. Let me drop it. Kinetic energy of the droplet dropping to the surface of that substrate. They not only knock down, but also bond temporally into the structure, creating enough of current to light up 100 LEDs at 100 volts. What they didn't give is the current. So We don't know what kind of LEDs, how much current they draw, and what is the process, but by only looking at the words that I'm saying, it is easy to find in the internet that recent finding of the Korean scientists and researchers.
Yes, Wesley, I read the articles. I read all the articles. None of them really make a great deal of specific fact. There's some vague claims and really, really poor English that's technologically not really realistic. But it seems to be a kinetic energy transducer, that the kinetic energy of water drops hitting a surface are enough to elicit a current. So it's sort of like a piezoelectric device. It seems to implement field effect transistor technology. And again, there are some claims that I'm not quite sure whether it's mistranslation or someone taking a hallucinogen. But it was sort of interesting, but there's so little on it, and there's so little to kind of grab onto that it's more of a claim than it is a true discovery of anything.
And you sure, or you think that this is not a hoax?
Bottom line is, I don't know. The reason I don't know is primarily based upon there's absolutely no published material that goes into detail. There's all these, I assume, translated poorly reports and stories that got more press release than a scientific research project discussion. So maybe at some point they'll publish something that's more scientific that you can kind of grab on and make sense out of. But right now, most of these articles, if you kind of trace them all the way back to their origin, end up being more like a publicity release than a doctoral paper or any kind of research paper that I've ever read.
In end of 90s, before September 11, I had my office in Water Trade Center 1 at 77th floor, and at that time we were filing a patent application that was actually approved as patent, so we got a physical patent for extracting images from the earth using resonance acoustical profiling of the earth. So that was, we could cut the earth, not cutting the earth, to the depth of 2 kilometers, 1.5 miles, and see everything, the variation between sand and gravel and a clay or whatever is there, and the pipes and the bunkers and whatsoever, let me drop.
Moving on.
And we were using at that time piezoelectric material that was embedded in a metal spike sort of coning structure that we actually inject or put on the surface of the earth, and then a WebDOS program at that time using at the end the PhotoStyler, which was the regular editing program, we were able to have those cuts of the earth created. We were dealing with, at that time, with NASA, Department of Defense, and other, plenty of other Army Rangers, DARPA. Let me drop. The reason that I'm telling you that is that if that Korean droplet dropping structure is of any difference to the regular piezoelectric material that reacts exactly the same way. So what we were doing, we were sensing the ever-existing vibration of the earth, and based on the frequency of this vibration, we were able to create that underground image. The lower was the frequency that was coming from the earth, so it was a passive device. The deeper was that frequency originating from. So now I know that the piezoelectric material is very sensitive, but the current is picoamperes or nanoamperes or microamperes at best. Yes, if you stock them, you can have a milliamperes. That's why I would like to ask you, Dr. Roy, about your thought about what current at 100 volts they could possibly be able to get from the droplet dropping to sort of the structure that was already described. And to explain.
Well, Wesley, you know, as I mentioned, they're very light on any kind of details. Is it possible to transduce, to convert kinetic energy into electromotive force? Yeah, sure, you can transduce all kinds of things. Is it possible to stack the transducers in such a case to have a differential electromotive force of 100 volts? Yes. The big problem is, as you mentioned, that they don't speak of current at all, like it's not important, which it is incredibly important. And by, you know, saying it's 100 volts, but it's, you know, they use very, very high efficiency LEDs that require a fraction of a milliamp, that would be important to the paper, which doesn't exist. So although I think it's an interesting report of a paper that someday I may be able to read, I can't really judge it much because of its dearth of any kind of actual factual detail.
Thank you very much for that, and I do thank you for your time. And to exchange.
Welcome, Wesley, and thanks for your participation tonight. I will drop for a second, and then I will go into my little stories here. Okay, the prospect that the new coronavirus, whose outbreak has been so far largely confined to China, would become pandemic, seemingly becomes more likely as time goes on. This past week, several countries have reported local clusters of the disease outside of mainland China, suggesting that the virus is freely circulating there. Meanwhile, a new report estimates that only a third of cases that have left China's borders are being documented at all. On Friday, South Korean health officials reported a dramatic jump in the case of COVID-19, as the disease is now officially known. There are currently 602 cases in Korea, more than double the number reported days earlier. Iran's health ministry reported 14 new cases on Sunday, bringing Iran's total up to 43, along with 4 deaths. Italy reported 78 new cases, some of which were not connected to travel from China. In total, there have been close to 79,000 cases of COVID-19, with more than 2,400 deaths, nearly all in China, since the outbreak began last December. There have been more than 2,000 cases outside of China, with the largest bulk of cases, over 600, involving people on board the Diamond Princess cruise ship now being held off the coast of Japan that was allowed to dock. These newest waves of cases in South Korea and elsewhere indicate that we are heading into a dangerous new phase of this outbreak. The virus is now routinely showing up in people who didn't catch it from recently traveling in China. Places like Iran, we're also seeing cases where the chain of transmission is a complete mystery. That means there are almost certainly blind spots where the virus is spreading in communities without detection. The more unwanted sparks of disease there are in a country, the more likely they'll erupt into a full-blown wildfire that will sustain the outbreak and turn it into a pandemic. Let me drop for a sec. Health officials from the World Health Organization are warning just that. Quote, I believe that the window of opportunity to contain the outbreak is still there, but that the window of opportunity is narrowing, end quote, the World Health Organization Director General said during a press conference held this past Friday. On Friday, epidemiologists from the Imperial College London in the United Kingdom also released their latest report on the outbreak. They concluded the strict level restrictions and quarantines implemented in China, which haven't come without some controversy, likely did slow down the outbreak globally. But the situation still looks dire to them. They estimated that two-thirds of all travel-related cases exported outside the country have gone unnoticed, potentially resulting in multiple chains of an as-yet undetected human-to-human transmission outside mainland China. wealthier countries like the United States are better equipped, if not necessarily smarter, at catching these cases before they spread. But on Friday, health officials announced 19 more cases, bringing the U.S. total to 34, though the increase was largely due to passengers returning from the Diamond Princess cruise ship. They also warned that more cases would undoubtedly show up. Quote, this new virus represents a tremendous public health threat, said Nancy Messonnier, director of the National Center for Immunization and Respiratory Diseases at a press conference held Friday afternoon. In many countries with poorer health care systems, the point of no return will be even harder to avert. One major problem highlighted during the WHO's press conference is the lack of resources being funneled to these countries. Earlier this month, the World Health Organization called for member countries to send $61.5 million to help fight the outbreak. But as of February 19th, countries have collectively pledged to give less than half that, around $26 million, and only $1.2 million has actually been received, according to the World Health Organization. Of course, the outbreak has already hit Chinese economy hard, and a pandemic will undoubtedly cost the world far more in lives and money than what the World Health Organization is asking for now. Anyway, let me drop for any questions or comments. This is AC2GS. Okay, I always want to add to people, I think that the progression of the Wuhan coronavirus from a singular site of infection to possibly a pandemic is important, and I just wanted to place this infectious disease in perspective to other nasty things that have been out there for a long time. According to the CDC, the Center for Disease Control and Prevention, whose budget next year is threatened to be further cut, they estimate that somewhere between 29 to 41 million cases of influenza have been tracked in the United States, and somewhere between 16,000 and 41,000 deaths due to influenza have been estimated from October 1st, 2019 to February 15th, 2020. So keep in mind that we don't panic about influenza, but we're sort of beginning to panic about Wuhan virus. Just want to add that to the mix. Let me drop for any questions or comments. This is AC2GR. Okay, here's my third in the trilogy of virus stories. The problem with COVID-19, the new name for the Wuhan coronavirus, is that it might be deadlier than the common influenza virus. Recently, an analysis of 44,672 coronavirus patients in China whose diagnoses were confirmed by laboratory testing, out of those, they had found 1,023 had died by February 11th. Now, that's a fatality rate of 2.3%. Figures released on a daily basis suggest that the rate has further increased in recent days. That is far higher than the mortality rate of seasonal flu, with which the new coronavirus has sometimes been compared. In the United States, the flu fatality rates hover around 0.1%. The new analysis was posted online by researchers at the Chinese Center for Disease Control and Prevention. Overall, about 81% of patients with confirmed diagnoses experienced mild illness. The researchers found nearly 14% had severe cases of COVID-19. Of the disease caused by the new coronavirus, and about 5% had critical illnesses. 30% of those who died were in their 60s, 30% were in their 70s, and 20% were age 80 or older. Though men and women were roughly equally represented among the confirmed cases, and men made up nearly 64% of the deaths. Patients with underlying medical conditions such as cardiovascular disease, diabetes, or diabetes died at higher rates. The fatality rate among patients in Hubei province, the center of China's outbreak, was more than seven times higher than that of the other provinces. And looking at the epidemiological studies released regularly, for some strange reason, Iran seems to have a higher mortality rate. It's something over 5%. Now, my gut sense is that it's not any higher than the 2.3% suggested by earlier studies in China, but that Iran has a problem either finding people with a
a subclinical case of Wuhan virus or a tendency not to mention it to the outside world. So I think something's funny going on with Iran's numbers. Anyway, let me drop for any questions or comments. Once again, this is AC2GS.
GXM.
Yes, Rich.